Right, well, welcome to this podcast, and especially to my guest, Kent Bruce, a broadcaster who I regard as an authentic man of radio. Now, was radio always your destination, or did you, when you start, think maybe it might be a stepping stone onto something else?
I've never regarded it as a stepping stone, and actually, I used to, and I don't any longer, but I used to despise people who did. I thought they were users, simple users of radio, and I always felt radio was where I had a natural feel to be, and always felt, when I walked into a radio studio, even from the very first day at a hospital radio station, I felt, this is it. This is the right place. This is where I ought to be. And I've always felt entirely comfortable. Not anywhere else. You know, put me in a television studio and I get on edge, put me in any other situation. On a stage, I'm a bit keyed up. But in a radio studio, it's home. It's absolutely home and always has been.
Can you say, remember even, why you felt like that? Why you were drawn to it?
I'm not sure how it started. I think I was a big radio listener when I was growing up. I grew up in the 50s. I was a child in the 50s. And I used to listen to the comedy programs on the Light program and on the Home Service. And I used to listen a bit to Radio Luxembourg, but it wasn't in Scotland, the west of Scotland. The reception was not great. I know a lot of people say, oh, we used to listen to Luxembourg under the covers. Well, when we listened to Luxembourg in Scotland, you got about 20 seconds of beautiful clarity, and then it faded away and disappeared and came in and all sorts of noises. And then after about another minute, it came back. So you only ever heard maybe the first 20 seconds and the last 20 seconds of any song that was being played on Luxembourg. And you could hear the beautiful patter of the disc jockeys, which disappeared halfway through. So you never knew how they finished the stories. But it was wonderful. I loved listening to Luxembourg.
You sound like it might have been a bit like me. I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, but I used to listen to... I'd love to have said that I listened to all these rare R&B tracks coming through AFN on the continental. But, I mean, in fact, it was PC49 and yeah. Journey into Space yeah. and all those sorts of things. While you were listening to that, you must also have caught little bits of music coming through the old Light programme. Can you remember what sort of tracks were filling your consciousness?
Well, most of the stuff you heard on the Light programme in the 50s and early 60s was on children's favourites. And so you got The Runaway Train and bits of Hole in the Ground by Bernard Cribbins and stuff like that. You didn't really get a lot of pop music on children's favourites or indeed on the Light programme. When you did get pop music, it was usually played by the NDO, the Northern Dance Orchestra, or some such. And very good they were, a fantastic orchestra, but it wasn't the originals, the original records you heard. And occasionally, I mean, we used to listen to Desert Island Discs, believe it or not, to hear some pop music. And usually it was some very worthy person who chose nothing but eight records of the deepest classical music. And you think, oh, God, here we go. You would love it if somebody actually chose a pop record. It was very difficult to hear them. Only time, really, you heard them was on Pick of the Pops.
I think the social lives of the NDO, Northern Dance Orchestra, were much more interesting than the music they were delivering to us. But I think that's probably yes. for an interview on another occasion.
Well, yes, and I worked with a similar orchestra in Scotland, the SRO, and that was an experience. But yes, maybe that's for another time. Yeah.
Those guys knew how to enjoy
oh,
life.
Yes.
I always thought. Your obviously very successful career has been conducted totally within the confines of... Auntie BBC, you've obviously been comfortable. I wonder, were you ever tempted, have you ever been tempted, maybe at a low spot or something, to think maybe I should go and try the wicked wiles of commercial radio?
Well, as you quite rightly say, in every career there are low spots. There are moments when you think, why am I, you know, why do I stick here? Why do I do this? And then that's the moment when you do think, well, perhaps maybe there's a greener field somewhere else. However, I was always, as you quite rightly say, a BBC boy. I wanted to join the BBC when I was young. It wouldn't have been the same if I'd gone to commercial radio. And there have been moments when, I'm flattered to say, the occasional offer has come from commercial radio. But it's never been sufficient to make me think, yeah, well, no. Because I've always trusted the BBC to get it right eventually. It doesn't get it right a lot of the time. But when it's going through a patch where it's not fulfilling what I think is its correct remit, and I'm talking particularly about music radio, then I think I do trust in it to somehow put itself right, that it will all turn, and I have been there long enough now to have seen this happen, it does turn out more or less all right in the end.
It is the great survivor.
Yeah.
I mean, and considering what it's been through in the kind of the political journalistic area in the last few weeks and months, you know, I guess it will come through again.
I think it will. I'm sure it will. And, you know, Radio 2, taking that, where I've been for 30 years now, I've seen it change markedly in that time. It's been through highs and lows and some extremes of music policy. And I always thought, well, that's not quite right, but it will sort itself out. It will come back more to where it should be. And by and large, it has.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I'm an enormous fan of the BBC. I've worked for all parts of the industry, but it gives us something that we know we probably can't get from anywhere else and probably never will be able to. I referred to you, Ken, when we started, as an authentic man of radio. And I chose that phrase because I looked through the Radio 2 schedules and I noticed that only 6 of Radio 2's 17 mainstream presenters deserve such a description. The rest have all seemed to me to have made their names through other areas, through television principally, and they seem to be the ones who are always picked to advertise the station. I wonder whether for you, somebody who's, as I said, totally a man of radio, whether you ever kind of get any resentment, oh, God, they've dropped the stars in again.
Oh, yes, yes. It doesn't happen to me now, but it used to a lot. I used to feel dreadful resentment. In fact, there was one time where there was a huge advertising campaign. Now, I've never featured on a billboard for Radio 2, ever. They were running a huge billboard advertising campaign for one or two new broadcasters who had joined, and I thought, well, this is not fair. And I investigated and priced what it would cost to put bus advertising on the side of the 88 bus, which of course runs past Broadcasting House. And it wasn't actually that much. It was quite, and I really came close to booking posters which said Ken Bruce in the morning on BBC Radio 2 to stick on the buses for a month that ran up and down Portland Place. And it wasn't that expensive in the great scheme of things. And I came close to doing it simply for the enjoyment of seeing the people upstairs running around saying, who paid for that? Who authorised that? Whose budget is that coming off? And I would have loved that. But it doesn't really bother me now because I've survived. But the times when I thought I wasn't going to survive, it did bother me, yes.
Well, it may have been, of course, just down to your hairstyle. I mean, you know, you and I are particularly gifted in that area. I remember the DJ Mike Smith went off to America once when we were working together in Capital, and he came back with a T-shirt for me as a gift, and it unusually across the front said, God could only create so many perfect heads, the rest he covered with hair.
Do you know, I find myself in perfect agreement with that. It's my kind of religion.
Do you, when you're required to describe yourself, do you describe yourself as a broadcaster or as a DJ?
Broadcaster. Always have done. Because I was never going to be a DJ to begin with. I wanted to be in radio. As a teenager, but because I wanted to work for the BBC, I didn't want to be one of those pop DJs because I didn't think, well, I'm not that kind of person. I thought I'm not that kind of all teeth and tinsel, jazz hands kind of person. I'm a radio person. I'm not somebody who would want to go to a disco and spin the decks for, you know, hundreds of thousands of teenagers. And the idea of a Radio 1 roadshow, I just thought, no, that's not me. So I wanted to be a broadcaster, and the way I got in was to be an announcer, because a lot of the announcers in those days did programmes. It doesn't happen now. In fact, there's hardly an announcer left in the BBC. But they were the professional craft broadcasters, the announcers, people who could be put into any situation and make it sound right. And you're talking people like John Dunn, Ray Moore, people like that, and Roger Moffat in years gone, Keith Skews, people like that, who were BBC announcers, but they could do programmes and they had personality, but the personality was always directed towards making the material sound better. It was never just about, look at me, aren't I clever, aren't I funny? It was about making the whole programme sound good. And that's the kind of broadcasting I'd love to do that. And I'd love to be as good as these guys.
And I mean, it's interesting because I did one, I'll call low point in my career. I did do quite a bit of training DJs and presenters. And I remember I always used to say to them, what you need to do is to understand how to create the perfect context in which the listener can get the most out of the material you're presenting. And principally that meant the music. I mean, do you have a technique? Do you have a style? Do you have an objective when you're on air?
No, I wouldn't say so. My style is to make, my aim is to make the morning pass as nicely as possible as it can and to play as much music. I also have this terrible fear of boring people. I've always had that. So I think, well, don't talk for long. Keep it short, keep it crisp, keep it moving. Get yourself across, make sure people know it's you, but don't talk for ages. I could never do a talk radio phone-in, anything like that, because I just would say, well, I'm bored on Earth myself, so why should I expect other people to listen? But I couldn't talk for 10 minutes about nothing, which is what many of these people have to do.
I'm guessing that might be quite hard for you to exercise that discipline. I mean, you're a natural raconteur. I mean, I've obviously had conversation with you and seen you perform off-air when it seems to come perfectly naturally to tell a story.
Yes, but there are different ways of telling a story, perhaps. I mean, I think on radio, the story ought to be as short as possible. Brevity is everything. Brevity is the soul of wit, somebody once said, and, you know, I can't disagree with that. I think it should be as short as possible. If it takes you 10 minutes to say the same thing as you can say in 30 seconds, then do it in 30 seconds.
Well, in the same area, a very well-known disc jockey, I remember some years having a big debate with him, he complained to me and said, "You're making me present Acne Radio." His show was, as he saw it, covered in spots. And you have quite a few spots, features of the programme. I wonder how you relate to those and what you see as their significance and their role compared with your objective in direct communication with the listener.
Well, we've sort of refined the spots down to what I think is a very nice level. We don't have spot after spot after spot now. In the first half hour of the show, 9:30 to 10, there's nothing. It's just records and a travel bulletin. In the second hour, we've got a love song at 10:15, Pop Master, which takes up a good chunk, and that's that for that hour. And then in the third hour, there's really only the Tracks of My Years, which is 20 to 12. So we've brought it down to the minimum we can, I think. That also, I think, is very important about a show. It's got to be right for the presenter. It's got to suit the presenter's personality. And what the BBC has done beautifully for me is given me the right producers over the years and kept them with me so that we've done what we do and we've refined it down and down and down so that there are as few spots as possible. There are very few signposts just to keep you going. And I think sometimes when people come in to sit in for me, they find it a bit difficult because there aren't too many things to say, well, where am I going next? Well, for the first half hour, it's just you, you know. And so that, I think some people find that a bit difficult. They do get into the swing of it after a while, but there's a temptation among some people to talk too much, I think.
Well, I remember when Jim Moyer, soon after he got the job as controller of Radio 2, you may remember, he introduced Des Lynam to present, I think, was it just the Friday night, but one of the drive time shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Des didn't last very long at all because he came and he said, "Look, I'm awfully sorry." He said, "But, you know, all there is to do is to introduce records and I've got nothing to say about them. I need guideposts. I need things to head for. I need destinations."
Well, that's the difference. I mean, Des had done a lot of radio, but a different kind of radio. And, of course, he's a marvellous broadcaster, but of a different type. And that's why I think it is still important to have music radio people doing music radio, because it's a discreet craft. It is something that people can do or can't do. If they can do it, it's really quite easy. If they can't, then it becomes quite obvious. It's just people talking about what they did yesterday and what their children have done, you know, and it becomes actually just rather difficult to listen to.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because when I started out, to me, DJs, the music radio presenters, were the people who led me to something, who introduced me to a new experience, who shared their enthusiasms with me. I must say, looking overall at our radio industry, and in some areas Radio 2 is guilty of this as well, it seems to be increasingly enough just to have somebody who is a personality who doesn't necessarily have any feel for the music. How important do you think it is for you to have a feel for the music?
Oh, it's absolutely vital. You've got to have a feel for the music to make it work. I often listen to Jeremy Vine is on holiday. A lot of different people are brought in, very often from the journalistic side of things. What you find is at the end of a disc, they'll just start reading the cue. They won't say that was, or say wasn't that great, or anything, make no comment about the music at all. I think, no. The music is an integral part of the programme, as important as the interview you're just about to do. So you give it as much weight as the interview. And so many people who are outside the music radio cabal, as it were, don't get that. And a lot of people who run at the BBC don't get that either. And it is so important to a listener to think that the presenter has ownership of the whole programme, the music as well.
We'll come back to perhaps talking about the people who run the radio, whatever, but you mentioned there talking about the features, that it's important that the features fit the personality of the broadcaster. What's your personality?
I don't know. I'm best judged to say that, really. I mean, I think it's for the... I think I'm a sort of dry observer, or a wry observer of life, really. And that's... I don't regard myself as a champion of any particular kind of music or of any particular style of broadcasting. I think I'm there to do a job, which is to make the morning lighter and happier for people. It's a pure entertainment show. It has no pretensions to being educational, although I think sometimes some of the features are. But I make no claims for it to be that way. I think it is just an entertainment show. And I don't regard myself as a comedian or an entertainer in any way, but I'm a radio presenter. And after all these years, I'm probably getting to be a good radio presenter. And that's what I think, that's what I bring to the show. I'm an ordinary bloke who's got an unusual job. That's the personality on air.
Okay, let's go back to that thing I mentioned. In recent months, the senior management of the BBC have been described as headless chickens, and sometimes much worse. Now, you've worked with several generations of what we euphemistically call the suits, and when they finally drag you, no doubt screaming from your final radio studio, how do you think you look back at the behaviour of the men and occasionally the women who've given you your orders?
Well, it'd be easy, as one of the coal-face workers, to say, they're all idiots, they don't know what they're doing. And of course, that's not true. But you do, from time to time, find yourself working under people who don't understand either you or, in my view, what your station is all about. As I said earlier, you just have to make the best of it until the wheel turns and somebody else comes there. But in broad terms, BBC management mean well. They mean tremendously well. Sometimes they're not terribly effective. I've never really come across anybody who was an out-and-out unpleasant person and was, determined to do something ridiculous just to please themselves. They did genuinely all think that they were doing the right thing for the audience. Sometimes they were wrong, but mostly they were right.
Yeah. You, alongside the morning show, which obviously you're most famous for, you've become a regular part of one of the network's longest-running shows, which is, of course, the almost world-famous Friday Night Is Music Night. Live performances, live audiences, usually live transmissions. It's a totally different undertaking from a man sitting in a little room like this with a hard disk full of music. What's the appeal?
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it, because I've always loved orchestras. This takes us back to the NDO and the Scottish Radio Orchestra, which I first worked with back in the 70s. And they were people after my own heart. I thought they were people, the kind of people that I thought I was. That is, professional, good at their job, but and also quite formal at their work, but also...
But they liked a bevy afterwards.
Oh, yeah, the great fun was pushing it as far as possible, but still being able to do the job properly. The orchestras back then in the 70s used to just drink and drink and drink. The Scottish Radio Orchestra particularly were infamous for it. And I joined them on many occasions. But they would always try to pull back from getting so bad that they couldn't perform. And it was this discipline. It was a sort of self-discipline. And I thought, that's the kind of person I admire. People who have made themselves very good at what they do. Any musician who got into a BBC orchestra had to be really talented, a great sight reader and a great sort of improviser. But they also had to be good fun to join in the spirit of things and able to do the job no matter what. And that's the kind of person I admired and thought
And
I
what
like.
About the aspect of working with a live audience in front of you, watching what you do, and you can see the whites of their eyes?
It's a different thing altogether. I still, doing that programme, work to the microphone. You think you've got 300 people, 400 people there watching you, but you've got a million listening. So that's where you do your performance too. But, of course, you want the people there to laugh and you want the orchestra to laugh. I like to throw in a couple of gags for the orchestra to make them laugh. And I've made them laugh, then I know I've hit the right audience. But work to an audience. I love working to an audience, as long as I'm not the centre of attention, because I'm not a stand-up comedian, but I am the facilitator of the whole show, and so therefore I like to make fun of the whole thing, do a bit of banter with the audience, have a nice time. But it's not me. It's not my show.
You say you're not the entertainer, whatever. But I mean, I've seen you at those shows, and I've seen other jocks at Radio 1 road shows and things like that, and they do come and queue up and ask for your autograph, and they do want a signed picture of you. So there is an aspect in which you have become the celebrity or one of the celebrities in the programme. I mean, how do you cope with that?
One of is fine. One of is fine. But the main stars are the musicians, the singers, the players, the orchestra. And so therefore, I'm just there to make it all run smoothly. I regard myself as part of the production team. It's my job to make it run smoothly, to make sure the audience are happy, and to make sure it comes out on time. That's part of my role. So I'm not the star of the show, and I never take a bow on a Friday night. They are the stars. I just come out and say thank you very much, because I'm the man who's running it.
Great. The death of our beloved medium has, of course, been frequently predicted at many times over the last few decades. At a time when anybody, really, in this country or in the world, can, with the use of their hard disk, with the use of their MP3 player, whatever, make up a playlist that's perfectly attuned to their musical taste. Why on earth do you think anybody chooses to listen to a radio station where somebody who they don't know and who doesn't understand their choices has chosen the music for them? Why does the appeal last?
Well, there are two reasons why people like radio. The first is that the person who's there is likeable. They're somebody you feel you get on with, and who makes you smile occasionally, makes you laugh, and somebody who has an interesting take on life, an interesting personality. The second aspect is that if you compile your own playlist, you're never going to be surprised by anything. Somebody else will play a record you may never have heard in your life, you may never have thought of listening to, and you'll hear that and you think, God, that's great. That is a great record. And, you know, I can count off hundreds of these that I've heard already. I've never heard that before. How have I missed that all these years? And immediately that becomes a new favourite. You'll never get that on your iPod. You will listening to radio. That's why. It's a simple thing. That's why.
So it's what we used to call serendipity.
Yeah, it's the happy chance.
Okay. Whenever I've met you in person, you come across as you've said yourself, you know, modest, unassuming, normal kind of bloke. Yet on air, you exude a real confidence in addressing the audience at large, the individual listener, the contestants who come in for Popmaster. You deliver gags, engage in banter with Lynn and others. So I just wonder whether you must be as self-confident as even the most glitziest of your colleagues, or is there something that happens when you go into a radio studio? Is there something in a studio that affects the personality of a broadcaster?
I think there is. I think it does instill confidence in you. I think if you are a radio broadcaster, as I said before, you go into the radio studio, you feel at home. This is my natural environment. It's, you know, if I'm a fish, it's my water. That's where I like to be. If you put me in a television studio, there's too much space, there are too many people involved. You can't be as spontaneous because the cameras won't catch it. You know, you have to have told the director what you're going to do. Everybody has to have a stake in it. In radio, you can still just go off in your own way as you want. And it's that feeling of coziness, of freedom, of just being at one with your surroundings that I think lends that confidence to you. And I think when you sit in a radio studio, if you're, you know, a natural, call it that, radio broadcaster, then you feel, I'm in control. I'm not frightened of anything. I'm not scared of anything going wrong, because I know if something does go wrong, I'll cope with it. And, you know, I know lots of broadcasters who are like that. I think if you are of the sort of nervy, edgy disposition, it shows in the voice, it shows in your approach to it, and the end result doesn't sound comfortable. Listeners like to feel comfortable, and they think the bloke is in there, knows what he's doing. Nothing will go wrong. If you believe that yourself, then everybody's happy.
When I was producing at the BBC, it was the custom quite often that on the regular shows, the producer wouldn't necessarily be in the studio with the presenter.
Yeah.
I mean, is that the same now, or are producers with you all the time?
All the time. Mainly because, well, a couple of things. Compliance culture, which I've no doubt you've talked about on many other occasions. But also because, technically, there's more to be done now. As you will remember, you know, 30 years ago, I would turn up at the studio, lots of people would, find the box, the programme box, which had been sent over from the Radio 2 offices, which were a quarter of a mile away in Charlotte Street. Broadcasting house, you turn up, box, no producer. You'd get in, you'd open up the box, there are all the records, you set them out in the right order, running order, and a pile of postcards. And the rest was up to you. And broadcasters were trusted and were hired because they were trustworthy people to do the programme properly. If they didn't do it properly, boom, out. Never worked again.
There's a sense now that not only are presenters not trusted, but the producers of the presenters are not trusted, because the BBC now has another layer, even beyond the producers, of people who simply check on the producers, who are checking on the presenters.
It's not watching the detectives, it's watching the producers now. There is that. But also, technically, I mean, there are emails and texts and things which are happening immediately, and so they have to be filtered and passed to you. And so you do need somebody there. And I mean, I have no studio manager now in my broadcast. So the producer fulfills some of those functions, pushing phone calls through to my desk.
Anyone who's read your autobiography, which I did some time ago, knows that, as with most of us, your personal lives involved a few ups and downs as well. I wonder to what extent any of the things that haven't worked out for you, you might blame the fact that you chose a career in broadcasting as opposed to something more stable.
Probably, yes. Certainly in my younger days, when I was in much more of a hurry, shall we say, to get on, I sort of knew what I wanted to do, which was, strangely, to get on Radio 2. And even from the age of about 20-odds, because people like Ray Moore were in their 20s when they were starting on Radio 2, and I thought, well, yeah, of course, it's the style of the station which always suited me, as much as the music. The music didn't always suit me, but the style did. That direct, friendly, you know, never taking yourself too seriously approach. And certainly I was, as a young man, in too much of a hurry and didn't pay enough attention to what was going on at home. My marriage, my first marriage, certainly did suffer. But now, I think in my more recent years, I've come to the conclusion that I like what I do, but I'd probably enjoy it just as much if I were on radio next door rather than radio nationally. I could still be on the radio, I can't imagine never being on the radio. It's my job.
But you've grown up.
But I've grown up, and I think, it's not, my career is not the servant, or rather my career is the servant of my family rather than the other way around now.
Well, I've worked in radio. Last year was 50th anniversary, so it's not surprising that many of your former colleagues are also former colleagues of mine. And I wonder, when you think about people like Ben Lyons, Jimmy Mack, Alan Freeman, Jim Moyer, what are the qualities of the very best of the people you've worked with that you look back on and admire and say, they were really good?
I think the really great broadcasters, and the ones I've admired the most, are the ones who spoke directly to somebody at home or somebody listening. They had an immediate, direct form of communication. And as a listener, you tuned into that immediately. You felt that. You thought, this guy actually is not doing a show for lots of people. He's talking to me, one-to-one, man-to-man, woman-to-woman. It's just a simple dialogue between one person at one end and one person at the other end. That's where I feel radio is best. Of course, there are loads of ways to skin a cat. There are lots of different styles of radio where, you can sort of imagine a big audience there. But for the kind of radio I do, best, I think, it's one person talking to another person. And the people that you've mentioned, that I've mentioned too, like Ray Moore, I keep coming back to Ray, because he was, I thought, the archetypal
inspirational
broadcaster.
Guy.
I mean, and such a nice guy as well. And never took himself seriously at all. Didn't realise how good he was. And I loved that about Ray. But there are loads of other people. You mentioned Jimmy Mack in Scotland. He was a great broadcaster, an ability to bring people in. And producers like Ben Lyons, who was my first producer when I was in BBC Scotland and doing my own show. And such experience he had, and he always made me feel as if that was the best show that he'd ever worked on.
Well, I used to work with him on... he used to be the Scotland producer for the Radio 1 roadshows.
Yeah, he was a great sort of talent spotter, Ben. He was a great man for bringing on people and giving them their opportunities. And I'll always be grateful to him for making that first series I did when I was still a staff announcer as good as it could be.
I think that you mentioned there, you know, there's a natural modesty about the greats. I remember Alan Freeman, who for the last 25 years of his life, I didn't only produce him, but I had managed his career. And he said to me once when he was joshing, he said, if one of us had had my voice and your brains, one of us could have done really well.
But that's typical fluff. He was such a lovely man. I didn't know him for as long as I would have liked to have known him, but I did know him for about 15 years. And we worked together on Popscore, the great light entertainment show from Radio 2. And he was just the loveliest of men and always, always sweet and charming to me. He had no reason to be nice to me, this young upstart who'd turned up. But he was absolutely lovely to me. I thought he was a terrific guy.
Yeah, and much missed. Now, last question. When Desert Island Discs request your attendance...
I don't think they ever will, somehow.
Do you think if they did, you would find it easy to choose the eight records?
No, not at all. Not at all. I would first of all be tempted to choose all the serious classical pieces that everybody seems to when they ask their old music teacher, what should I choose? But I think if you do it properly, you choose pieces of music that either give you that feeling down the back of the neck, or you choose things that were important to you at a certain time. And I would be, the difficulty would be choosing whether it's music that sort of charted my life or music that made me go, oh, isn't that fantastic? And I think I would probably go for the, oh, isn't that fantastic kind of stuff, because at its best, music does that to you. And it's lovely to come across a new piece of music that has that effect upon you, as occasionally still happens. And when that stops happening, I'll probably stop doing that kind of programme.
Ken Bruce, thank you very much for finding the time to fit in this podcast into your schedule. Here's to many more years of you delivering music that sends a tingle down all our spines. And thanks also to Unique Facilities for hosting today's edition. Until the next time, bye-bye.